Hello, and welcome to the Hospice News Elevate podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about the growing demand for palliative care and the barriers that interfere with providers meeting those needs. With me today are Dr. Rachel Jordan, Director of Legislative Affairs and Advocacy at Hospice of the Chesapeake, and Dr. Christopher Paredes, a geriatrician specializing in home-based primary and palliative care. Both Rachel and Christopher receive trainings at universities that work with Adtalem Global Education.
All right. So thank you again so much to both of you for being here. Wanted to ask, what are some factors driving demand for hospice and palliative care right now? Dr. Jordan, would you like to start?
Sure. So we know that we have an aging population. So every day, 10,000 people turn age 65 and older. And so that's a big driving factor. But we also look at those who are living with chronic life-limiting illness. And it's not just those 65 and older. We're seeing more and more patients diagnosed with cancer early in. We're seeing more and more younger people living with chronic illness. When you think about the early onset of ALS and things like POTS. So we see this sort of extend over the lifespan, and we see the value of palliative care across the lifespan. So it's multifactorial. And for some regions, it can be more prevalent than others. I can tell you in the state of Maryland, we're kind of leading the nation in dementia diagnoses, especially in younger patients. And it may not be that way sort of out west. So it's also very regional in nature.
And Dr. Paredes, please.
You know, as a perspective from a geriatrics point of view, our population is aging. We see more patients with chronic diseases. We're starting to see people with functional decline. And that kind of population, as you know, is just exploding. Our baby boomers are now making up most of the aging population, and we're going to see that by 2030, you're going to see 1 in 5 people in the United States are will be 65 and older. So that if that doesn't tell you, that kind of frightens me, because we say 2030, and that's only 5 years away now. Right. So we're going to have a lot more patients, a lot more chronic diseases, a lot more challenges and barriers that we're going to see to deliver the kind of care we'd like to provide the population. So, yeah.
Thank you. And what are some of the challenges that threaten hospice and palliative care providers' ability to meet that demand?
So I can tell you specifically as a hospice provider. So the organization I work for, it's the largest independently owned not-for-profit hospice in the Maryland, Delaware, Virginia region. We face several challenges. A lot of them are environmental. So how do we actually get out to access our patients? We still deal with language barriers and health literacy barriers and just misconceptions about hospice, a lot of mistrust. The hospice is a beautiful thing, but one of the ways that it's written and administered in America is almost like a hard stop, right? I have to give up access to certain things that I hold valuable to my life, like dialysis, maybe palliative radiation. And so that hard stop feels really cruel. And a lot of people are very hesitant to enroll in hospice. And a lot of people assume that hospice and palliative care are one and the same. So that's a big barrier. I'll tell you specifically for our region, reimbursement rates for palliative care do not match the health and cost savings benefit that palliative care offers. So an organization that wants to operate a palliative care program, a lot of times they have to do it using philanthropy funding. They have to depend on other sources of funding to sustain that program, and they do it out of the kindness of their heart and because they recognize the need. So that's some of the things that really threaten the ability for palliative programs to be more robust and continuously show up for the communities how and where they need them.
Yeah, just to add to that, definitely barriers. To add to what Dr. Jordan is saying, some of the barriers we face, I work for an organization that provides home-based primary and palliative care to patients in the community. So we actually bring a interdisciplinary team, a call center, specially trained medics, all into the home. But a barrier we face is, one, people don't know about the kind of care we provide. Two, people don't understand, like Dr. Jordan said, what hospice or palliative care really means. People feel like they're giving up on their loved one when, in fact, palliative care will enhance their lives and the caregiver's life in giving that kind of care. And number three, it's insurance. Another barrier is, like she said, not only reimbursements, but again, coverage, insurance coverage. Not all insurances cover home-based care or certain palliative care that's needed for our patients. Yeah, we see that a lot, right, Rachel? A lot of people don't understand what palliative means.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I'm in the hospital and I order a palliative care consultation and the patient and family's like, oh, I don't need hospice, or, you know, I don't think that I'm terminal. And, you know, they're facing a new cancer diagnosis or a metastatic cancer diagnosis, pancreatic cancer, things that all the literature really says that we should initiate early palliative intervention for. The assumption is palliative and hospice are one and the same.
Is there also a shortage of hospice and palliative care physicians right now, as well as the other clinicians we've heard about? And if so, how does that factor into these issues?
I can give you actually a crazy statistic. My chief was just recently on a news network talking about how geriatric care needs to improve. Here in New York, we find that we have about 641 board-certified geriatricians, and we have over 4.6 million people above the age of 60. So that's like one doctor per 7,100 patients. Mm-hmm. So geriatrics also does palliative care and hospice care. And again, it's the shortage between our team, the hospice team. It's just primary care in general. You see that it's a big problem for our nation. Yeah,
I can tell you in our area, the primary care to patient, primary care provider to patient ratio is astronomical. So I think the answer to that question is yes, we're facing a shortage of healthcare providers on every end. You look at the shortage of OBGYN providers and pediatricians and, you know, endocrinology is one in our area. If I need to refer you to an endocrinologist or a rheumatologist, good luck. 6 months to get in. So we are facing a significant shortage, especially as our population A, ages, and B, they're now living with chronic life-limiting illness. You know, people are younger and younger being diagnosed with diabetes and hypertension, and that has an entire fallout for the entire body. So we definitely face significant shortages throughout globally.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And of course, there's also the matter of reaching underserved populations. You know, many people don't have access to hospice and palliative care. What are some of those underserved communities and what are some of the barriers that they face?
So I live in a predominantly African-American community, mm-hmm. and then followed by a large Hispanic population in the region that I serve. And so one of the things that my organization, Hospice of the Chesapeake, really prides itself on is knowing the communities that we serve and sort of targeting our educational interventions and where we show up in the community. There's a lot of mistrust, especially in communities where there's historically been a lot of mistrust in the medical system. So when you think about the African-Americans and things like the Tuskegee experiment, Henrietta Lacks, there's just this great fear. And then you talk about end of life care, which is even more fearful. And then also put yourself in the shoes of someone who does not speak English as their primary language. Things does not, they don't translate over as well. Or culturally, it is just very taboo to talk about death and dying. That's one of the biggest barriers that we face. Like we need to gain the trust even to access that community. So when you take a specific look at what each community holds near and dear to its heart, whether it's targeting faith-based institutions or having someone on staff that speaks that language, that understands that culture, so that we can tailor the care to meet that need. That, you know, that's really, really important for reaching these underserved communities.
Right. With us, with the service that we provide, we actually serve all communities, underserved. And the way we approach those patients is we're actually bringing the care to their home. So once we bring care to the home, unfortunately, we do come across some barriers delivering that care, but we found a lot. We found some workarounds to make sure that we bring that care to their home, educate the importance of this kind of care we're providing, and being that bridge back into the healthcare system is a way that our home-based primary care service addresses that issue of the lack of access to care, is we'll bring it to them. The unfortunate part, again, is we're mainly a Medicare service. So again, it's an insurance thing. We need to, I feel, again, we need to kind of expand criteria. We have to expand who's eligible to receive this kind of home-based care. But yeah, we definitely do our best to serve those in the community. One of the things that we also do is in my health system, we have a mobile unit that actually goes out into the communities and actually give primary care to those that are homeless. So we actually have a unit, a team that goes out to certain areas and try to deliver primary care as well.
Yeah. You bring up a really interesting point when you talk about delivering care in the four walls of someone's home. I think that is a phenomenal aspect of really getting to know a patient and what's most important to them. Sure, they can come to a clinic and they can come into the four walls of a medical facility, but I'm not going to see what's causing them to have falls. I'm not going to see what's causing them to have uncontrolled hypertension. I'm not going to see what those psychosocial influencers are that impact their ability to be compliant with treatment or even understand what treatment is. And so with hospice and palliative care, I get to go and sit at their dinner table. I get to look around their home and do a safety evaluation. I get to look in their cabinets and see what they're eating and provide education at a level that they understand, because everything is custom tailored when you're in the home. But it also creates this like safety blanket, because now I'm in their space and they're in control. You know, everything that we do is a partnership. I'm your partner in healthcare. You're my partner. But when I come into your home, I'm your guest. And so I operate within their safety net. So they're a little more open, maybe not initially, because it's foreign to have a provider in your home. It's just not the usual way. But then they become a little more comfortable, and then you develop that relationship. And it's like, you know what? Just come on in. Don't even knock. I know you're coming at 2. And they become more comfortable and they open up. And then you get to know their family and their favorite pet and their dog. And then you can come in and you can see when something's not right.
Right.
Right. You're in their space and you're like, you don't look well today. Tell me what's going on. So that's the beauty in really seeing someone in the environment that they're in majority of their life. They're only in my clinic for a moment of time.
Right.
But you're in your home majority of the time. And that's where I need to see you, because that's where you live and you thrive.
That's an act. Those are both. Those are all excellent points. Appreciate that. I'm curious to get your perspective on what are some things that hospice and palliative care providers can do now to help mitigate some of these issues?
I would say one of the biggest things that hospice and palliative care providers can do initially is get to know the community that they're serving. And whether that's looking at health studies, typically most counties will do them at least every 2 years. You get to know your population. You want to know what are some of the higher mortality and more things causing mortality and morbidity in your community. And then you custom tailor your plan to meet that need. There's nothing worse than trying to make a square fit into a circle hole. You've got to show up when and how the community needs you. And you've got to readjust. You're never going to stick with plan A because the needs of the community are going to change. And you may try one endeavor that does not work. Well, maybe it works exceedingly well, but you can't stay there. You have to be willing to change. And I think that that's something that hospice and palliative providers do well because the regulations are constantly changing. Like we just heard today, they're going to extend telehealth till September, October, 2025. But telehealth has been so influential and beneficial for us because now we can reach populations far beyond what we can physically get to. So we have to be ready to shift and pivot. And I think those are some of the things that we can do now to address issues that are going to come up in the future. We need to anticipate and prepare for that.
Yes, definitely. And another way to kind of address this issue is turning to the future, right? Looking and starting to educate those about hospice, palliative care, home-based care to the future, medical students, nursing students, all the different interdisciplinary, kind of educating them on this kind of care is important. Learning the community, seeing what the person's advanced care plan or goals of care are. But definitely, as physicians, clinicians, we're also educators. So educating the future is another way to make sure that people can get this kind of care that they need. So that's another way of kind of addressing this issue, is implementing more structure, more kind of instruction on this population, and teaching other clinicians how to handle this.
That makes a lot of sense. I know medical and nursing students generally speaking, get very little exposure to hospice or palliative care during their clinical studies.
Even NPs, right? Not as much exposure. Residents, physicians, not as much exposure until fellowship or after. But changing that to address the, I think everyone studying medicine or healthcare should understand what they can do to help our aging population to what skill set they have.
Yeah. Are there things that need to change on a public policy level to help address these issues?
Absolutely.
That's Rachel's forte right there. You could preach on about that.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, in my role, I'm a nurse practitioner by training, but I'm actually the director of legislative affairs and advocacy with Hospice of the Chesapeake. So I get to marry my clinical experience with that of policy and regulations and lawmaking. And I also sit as the secretary for the Board of Nursing for my state. And so I see firsthand how some of these policies may have been applicable for a certain time period. But as medicine has evolved, as our population has evolved, as we've started to see people become sicker and sicker and live with chronic illness much longer, we have to address the policies. When you think about hospice, and I talked about that hard stop, you think about a cancer diagnosis when the hospice, the Medicare hospice benefit came into existence. It is nowhere near what the diagnosis looks like now. A diagnosis of pancreatic cancer then was almost certain that you were going to pass away in the next few months. And now we have people living with pancreatic cancer, and they're doing treatment that's not geared at curing the cancer, but more palliative in nature. Now there's room for palliative radiation, palliative chemotherapy, surgical procedures that are more palliative in nature. And these are things to improve the quality of life. Yet the current hospice benefit says, there's no coverage for those things. And that's just not fair. And so it is so important that we update the policies and procedures now so that they reflect where medicine has advanced to. Medicine has never, it's never been complacent. Medicine has always grown. It's a body of knowledge. And so hospice needs to grow with that body of knowledge so that we can manage these patients appropriately and really improve quality of life. So the answer to that question is absolutely we need to change policy. And we have to do it every 2 years. Just like medicine evolves, these policies need to evolve with the medicine.
And it's hard to just say one part of policy because, like Rachel said, there's tons of things, policies about caregivers and what they're afforded to. Because I know not everyone, unless you're in hospice, can get respite care. Mm-hmm. If you're a burnt out caregiver, is one example. And then again, it's just this, the Medicare or kind of structure that we have in terms of policies, this started maybe 30 or more years ago, and it's not reflecting what's happening now. We're starting to have that shift where before our Medicare was the younger, healthier people would kind of help those in need. But now the population has shifted where there's going to be more chronically ill people than the healthier people working. So things have to change in terms of reimbursement, in terms of, there's just too many to kind of like list out, but a lot of policies have to change for everyone to get this kind of care.
Absolutely.
Well, those were all of my questions. Again, I really appreciate you both being here today. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'd like to once again thank our speakers, as well as all of you for tuning in. I hope you all take care.